each meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed.
Millennia ago, from the little cave on the tiny island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, the heavens opened. Since then, the world has been fascinated by the cosmic upheaval brewing on the horizon of history. The upheaval is now upon us. It is within us. To some degree, it always has been. But there has been a sudden and violent shift in the affairs of the world. The winds have changed. Heaven will not be silent. Let's now join Father Anthony Bush, pastor of St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago, and author of A Mother's Plea, For the Winds Have Changed. Together we can pave the way for a hopeful response to the signs of our times.
Due to technical problems, we now join Winds of Change already in progress.
What is needed in the liturgy today? The reform issues, the old mass versus the new mass. What can we learn? What are we expecting to see? There's so many unanswered questions, and there's a lot of questions that I, quite frankly, won't be able to answer now or today, as we're waiting for the church, especially bishops and cardinals and whatnot, make some changes, we might say, that even if they don't affect you personally, they will affect some people greatly, and that is should be a concern for everyone, as it were. Okay. Anyways, I'm Father Tom Coyes, a guest host, and you are listening to the Winds of Change on the new EWTN Catholic Radio, Voice of Chicagoland, WSFI Catholic Radio on AM 750 WNDZ and on 88.5 FM WFSI.
How long has it been since you have been to church? Busy schedule? Work? Or just lost interest? To be Catholic is not just merely attending Mass as just another weekend activity to be checked off the to-do list. Participation in the sacred liturgy gives you the opportunity to be intimately connected to Christ through the Holy Eucharist. You can also cleanse yourself of sin through the sacrament of reconciliation as a baptized Catholic. Come before the iconic monstrance to be in Christ's presence in the sacred silence of the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy. St. Stanislaus Kostka Church is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. St. Stan's is just off the Kennedy, 2 blocks north of Division on Noble. Come back to Christ through the sacred liturgy and his gift of the sacraments at St. Stan's.
The Winds of Change.
St. Stanislaus Kostka Academy. St. Stan's is an exceptional private elementary school in Chicago, serving preschool, age 3 and 4, pre-kindergarten, kindergarten, and first grades. We incorporate Catholic values and rigorous academic social-emotional learning, Chinese, Spanish, STEM, and more, providing our students with leadership and life skills to transform our world. St. Stanislaus Kostka Academy is conveniently located 1 block north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway. To schedule your tour, visit ststanschicago.org. ststanschicago.org.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. Father Tom Coyes here. You are listening to Winds of Change. This is Brain Wrinkling Wednesday. I started with the topic of purgatory, since it is the month of November now. And one more story from this incredible little pamphlet called Read Me or Rue It. This one's about a Polish prince, a noble family, of course. So this Polish prince, who for some, let's see if I find out where this comes from. What saint does it explain? I got to look it up a little bit more, but trust me, it's not just made up comes from some well-documented, fact-checked sources, right? Let's see. Or maybe it's St. Athanasius. This looks like an Archbishop of Florence. Okay, so this Polish prince, who for some political reason had been exiled from his native country, bought a beautiful castle and property in France. Unfortunately, he had lost the faith of his childhood and was at the time of our story engaged in writing a book against God and the existence of a future life. Whoa, Polish prince that lost his faith living in France? Probably had too many croissants or drank too much French wine, right? Any of you who are listening that have Polish roots, I gotta say, as a non-Polish person, though of Slovak origin, kind of cousins, but I'm more of an American than a Slovak, as anybody who knows me would explain. I used to always think that all Polish people here in America, especially here in the Chicagoland area, because that's where I'm mostly have my experiences.
You just wrinkled my brain, man.
All the Poles are such strong, good, hearty Catholics. Unfortunately, not always the case, my friends. And that's that can be quite a... let's just say it. Evangelization, working, building up catechesis, strengthening our morals, understanding the deep and beauty of the sacraments. It's for one and all. Even the good old Polish people that love to wrap themselves in the mantle of Our Lady of Częstochowa or hang a beautiful picture of John Paul II. It's a little bit like Mexicans who love the Guadalupe image, but really aren't that fervent Catholics, right? Anyways, I digest. Let's go back to the story here. Unfortunately, this prince had lost his faith in his childhood and was engaged in writing a book against God. Strolling one evening in his garden, he came upon a poor woman weeping bitterly. He questioned her as to the cause of her grief. "Oh, my prince," she replied, "I'm the wife of John Marie, your former steward, who died 2 days ago. He was a good husband to me and a faithful servant to your highness. His sickness was long, and I spent all our savings on the doctors. And now I have nothing left to get masses said for his soul." The prince, touched by her grief, said a few kind words, and though professing no longer to believe in a future life, gave her some gold coins to have masses said for her husband's soul. Sometimes after, it was again evening, and the prince was in his study working feverishly on his book. He heard a loud rap on the door, and without looking up, called out to the visitor to come in. The door slowly opened, and a man entered and stood facing the prince's writing table. On glancing up, what was not the prince's amazement? Was not the prince's amazement to see Jean-Marie, his dead servant? Looking at him with a sweet smile, "Prince," he said, "I come to thank you for the masses you enabled my wife to have said for my soul. Thanks to the saving blood of Christ, which was offered for me, I am now going to heaven. But God has allowed me to come and thank you for your generous alms." He then added impressively, "Prince, there is a God, a future life, a heaven, and a hell." Having said these words, he disappeared. The prince then fell upon his knees and poured forth a fervent prayer. "I believe in God, the Father Almighty, creator of heaven and earth." Bingo. End of the story. Powerful. No, these are the stories that come from saints, hearing from different people that have come upon these stories.
Wow.
So you might easily dismiss them as fantasy,
brain,
as made up. trust me, there stranger things have happened, and doesn't it make sense that strange things, supernatural things, if God can raise, if Jesus died and rose from the dead, if he made miracles, then certainly these things can and should be thought of as possible, right? So, okay, the next thing I want to share with you is a little episode from another mystic. I started this book a little bit ago, and it's Luisa Picaretta, that another mystic, a lay woman, and she, I'm going to read this little section about how she wanted to do everything for God, and yet her past sins often plagued her, and how God wanted her to know that that he had done away with them, he had forgiven them, and her inability to really move along, you know, sometimes our sins kind of drag us down. That's why I think so much, that's a very common, powerful theme in most Protestant sermons, is the theme that you can't work your way into heaven. It's only God's great grace, which is a Catholic theme as well, too, not only Protestant sermons. But we have the sacrament of reconciliation, of a sacrament of penance, of course. And so we can encourage people to go to confession and have their sins forgiven, but they don't have that. So there's a constant, almost a command to the people to forget or to realize that those sins have no power over you again. And that's what this little episode in Luisa's, this is book one of the book that's put together called The Book of Heaven. I primarily wanted to dive into this because, well, quite frankly, I'm curious about heaven. I want to know more. When visiting my elderly mother, she sometimes says, "What's heaven going to be like?" And it's hard to answer that question, isn't it? We don't have that many examples and stories, but needless to say, we know something, and it'll be trying to overcome her past sins, right? He told me, "I do not want you to think about it. When a soul has humbled herself, convinced of having done wrong, and has cleansed her soul in the sacrament of confession, and is ready to die rather than offend me, it is an affront to my mercy. It is a hindrance to drawing her close to my love, because her mind is always trying to roll in the past mud. She also prevents me from letting her take flights towards heaven, because she is always with those ideas wrapped within herself. If she tries to think about it, and then see, I no longer remember anything. I have perfectly forgotten about it. Do you see any rancor or shadow on my part?" She says, "No, Lord, you are so good. But I felt my heart split with tenderness. Well then, are you the one who wants to carry these things on?" And she says, no, I do not want to. Let us think about loving and contenting each other." From that time on, I did not think about it so much. I did as much as I could in order to content him, and I prayed that he himself would teach me what I should do in order to repair for the past. And he said to me, "I am ready to do what you want. See, the first thing that I told you I wanted from you was the imitation of my life. So let us see what you lack." Beautiful, isn't it? That is,
wow.
It is a challenge.
You just wrinkled my brain, man.
Recognize great sin and to forget about those sins, to do the penance, to do the sufficient tears, though sometimes an ocean of tears isn't enough, right? Sometimes people get, stuck in the repentant side of things, but the moving on. And I love that line. That is, here's the conditional thing. Once you say, I am ready to die rather than offend you again, bingo, that reaches that element which we call perfect contrition, right? I'm ready to die rather than offend you again. That's the key, as it were. She goes on here a little bit more, which is, I have to, if you do know this mystic, and almost all mystics, they shock us with some odd spirituality, and they're odd in one sense, but they're not odd, especially if we put them in the context of a crazy world that they're living in. And one of the things she has here, which I notice, is that her senses, even the delightful, there's some of the thoughts of her bad thoughts, obviously, impure thoughts or whatever you try to put away. But what about nice thoughts or good thoughts? Like even delighting in what you see. She goes here in another spot. Jesus would say to me, I have created everything for love of you, and you deprive your sight of this delight for love of me. Even in the most innocent and holy things, for example, the cloths for the altars, the processions, he would say to me, you must take no other pleasure but in me alone. If I was sitting while working, he would say to me, you are too comfortable. Don't you remember that my life was a continuous suffering? And you, in order to content him, I would immediately shift to half of the chair, leaving the other half empty. And sometimes jokingly I said to him, see, O Lord, half the chair is empty. Come and sit near me. Sometimes it seemed he would content me, and I felt such delight that I myself cannot express it. So she's saying that sometimes even delights of the eye can take us away from the good Lord. And of course, that's, I think we all can see how that is true. We take, there are beautiful things we love to look at and contemplate. I certainly found you find yourself doing that with a beautiful scene, and you could give great glory to God for seeing such things, or it just could make you selfish and greedy, I guess you could say. Someone who sees a beautiful painting and just wants to buy it, own it, of course, if you're an art collector, that's part of your job, it's certainly natural to do that, but what this little insight from this mystic is telling me is that even the good things of this world can distract us from a greater attachment to God. So on this one part, she's talking about the beautiful things she sees with her eyes, and even then she talks about the good things that she tastes with her mouth. At lunchtime, I ate something tasty. Immediately, Jesus would reprimand me interiorly, saying, have you perhaps forgotten that I had no other taste but suffering for love of you, and that you must have no other taste but mortifying yourself for love of me? Leave it aside and eat that which you like least. And immediately I would take it and bring it to the maid, or I would say that I didn't want it anymore. And many times I remained almost on an empty stomach. However, when I would go to pray, I would receive so much strength and feel so satiated that I would feel nauseated for everything. Other times, then, in order to contradict me, if I did not feel like eating, he would say to me, I want you to eat for love of me. And as the food unites with the body, pray to me that my love may unite with your soul and everything will be sanctified. What that says to me, too, is that, man, just as so many of the created things can be used for our sanctification or our destruction, our spiritual destruction, God could pivot. God can use a good tasting meal to bring about greater grace and bring us closer to the good Lord, or he can have a good meal and it does separate us from him. We're in the beginning of November. We're going to think about Thanksgiving coming up, right? And certainly enjoying good food at Thanksgiving can bring you closer to your family members and closer to God. It can certainly bring you closer to God. But such an event, a good meal, I'm afraid this Thanksgiving and this Christmas is going to be even a greater challenge because of let's just say, the vaccine. There's so much tension. Some people are such hypochondriacs these days, and I hesitate to use that word with the people that are so nervous, but when you listen and follow the science about how few people are really dying from COVID, not that, one is too many, we can always say, but the fear of dying is creating great division within families. And at Thanksgiving coming up, there will be some who will say, I'm not coming over because you're not vaccinated, or somebody in the house will not be vaccinated, and I can't risk getting sick from being close to one of those people. Or if you're invited, they'll ask you, are you vaccinated? And if you say no, then they'll say, you can't come over. Indeed, that's that comes to my mind when I'm reading this episode in Luisa Picaretta's The Book of Heaven, as she's talking about even food can be, a tasty food can be something that will distract her from the love of God. It's part of creation, and anything of creation can take us away from the great love of God. Anyways, okay, I think it's time for another break, right, Nick? And I do want to dive into liturgy here a little bit, and especially, it's very worth our while to remember the Reformation. The Reformation, especially in England. Reformation obviously started in Germany, but there was an archbishop by the name of Cranmer who really changed the liturgy in incremental ways, and it's hauntingly interesting for us today. We're going to dive into that when we come back, okay? I am Father Tom Coyes, guest host on The Winds of Change, and you are listening to the new EWTN Catholic Radio Voice for Chicagoland, WSFI Catholic Radio on AM 750 WNDZ and on 88.5 FM.
Here's some good news. We are pleased to announce. Here's some good news. We are pleased to announce that St. Stanislaus Kostka is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, in answer to our Blessed Mother's call to open the doors. The Blessed Sacrament will again be exposed all day, every day, except when masses or other services are being held. You are invited to come and pray anytime, day or night. For your safety, we ask that you practice social distancing and wear a mask. Hand sanitizer is available, and St. Stan's has increased cleaning and sanitizing of the church, and a security person will be on site. More information can be found at ststanschurch.org. That's ststanschurch.org. St. Stanislaus Kostka is located 2 blocks north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway.
We are the students of St. Stanislaus Kostka Academy, and you're listening to The Winds of Change.
How long has it been since you have been to church? Busy schedule? Work? Or just lost interest? To be Catholic is not just merely attending Mass as just another weekend activity to be checked off the to-do list. Participation in the sacred liturgy gives you the opportunity to be intimately connected to Christ through the Holy Eucharist. You can also cleanse yourself of sin through the sacrament of reconciliation as a baptized Catholic. Come before the iconic monstrance to be in Christ's presence in the sacred silence of the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy. St. Stanislaus Kostka Church is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. St. Stan's is just off the Kennedy, two blocks north of Division on Noble. Come back to Christ through the sacred liturgy and his gift of the sacraments at St. Stan's.
Welcome back, everyone. Father Coyce here on a Wednesday, Brain Wrinkling Wednesday. It's promised I want to dive into a bit of history because it deals with liturgy and it deals with changes in the liturgy, liturgical reform, and it can't help but make us contemplate the discussion and the debates, especially now, with regard to how to do the worship of God right and proper. The issue of the Novus Ordo, which was the Catholic Mass written and remade after Vatican Council II, and the Old Mass, otherwise known as the Tridentine Mass, or TLM, as we sometimes say. And it's being debated a lot because there's an effort to limit it or to even eliminate it altogether. I think that it needs to be part of the fullness of our Catholic faith these days. So let's see. But going back here, this is from a book by Michael Davies. He's a big defender of tradition in the church. This is just a historical analysis. It's a diving into history from the many sources, the people that made the story, that were part of the narrative, that made history, right? The first point that is a challenge for me, I have to confess, is the difference between the birth of the Church of England and the birth of the Lutheran Church in Germany. There's a subtle difference, and if we can appreciate it, we will do well. That is the difference between heresy, the heresies that the Lutheran movement introduced and promoted and spread through Germany, and the first stage of the Church of England is called not heresy, but pushed the Church of England into schism. That little distinction is an important one, as it were. So let me read this. Which comes from, was it Eamon Duffy, I think it is, that wrote this. The first stage of the English Reformation had not been prompted by heresy, as it was the case in Germany, but by the insistence of the king on getting his own way in his greater matter, obviously the annulment, his marriage. No matter what the consequences for the faith that he had been honored for defending by the Pope. Although the repudiation of papal authority constitutes heresy, Hilaire Belloc is correct in stating that what took place under Henry VIII should be described as the schism. And he says this, its characteristic was not an effort at doctrinal heresy, but rather an effort to set up a national church identical or virtually identical in morals and doctrine with the universal church, and yet separated from the unity of the latter. Although the period, 1533 to 47, cannot but appear to us today as the beginnings of the English Reformation, yet it was not, while it was in progress, attached to the Reformation as we understand that term. I repeat, it was not an heretical movement in the common sense of the term heretical. That is, it did not combat any of the main doctrines such as were being combated so violently upon the continent of Europe. It did indeed deny the authority of the Pope, but it did not deny, but fiercely affirmed transubstantiation, the Mass, the whole of the sacramental system. We may put it simply by saying that to the ordinary man in his daily life and weekly religious duties, these things seem to go on exactly as they had been done before. The destruction of the monasteries had nothing to do with doctrine. Vows or celibacy were insisted upon as much as they had been, and indeed under much worse penalties than the past had known. And though there was plenty of Protestant talk amid the small enthusiastic minority, it was a minority which was persecuted as vigorously as, or more vigorously than, its colleagues were in any part of Christendom, especially in Europe, right? The reason this is significant is because it shows, the best way to understand this distinction that Hilaire Belloc, a very famous Catholic author, lived around the time of G.K. Chesterton, by the way, and everything. The best way I could try to point this out is, you know how easily people get upset when a famous Catholic person gets an annulment? I think of the Kennedy family, for instance. And many people will then quickly say, if you have enough money, you can buy yourself an annulment, which is a crude way of saying it, but that everybody knows what it kind of means by that. That example shows us, indeed, that it may be unfair and it may not be good pastoral work, but in and of itself, it's not declaring a heresy. It's a bad administration or bad pastoral practice. You're creating unfair competition, maybe you can say. But you could sort of compare Henry VIII at that initial stage of the English Reformation to someone like Kennedy, who was just wanted to be Catholic, doesn't want to leave Catholicism, doesn't want to ruin the sacraments, basically. They're not going to teach a new doctrine, but because there is a right of Catholics to get an annulment, then they could be used and abused. And so that's the kind of spirit in which the Church of England began its movement away from Catholicism. And the way that it was done is by making the king the supreme head of the church in England. So it really is what America has today, in the sense that King Henry VIII was very happy to keep a church with seven sacraments and a celibate priesthood and benedictions and sisters and monasteries and all the things that made up the Catholic Church, First Holy Communions, funerals, weddings. But he wanted to be the one who would have the final say. He being the Church of England or his successors.
Wow. Kings and queens. Well, you just wrinkled my brain, man.
Yeah, that is brain wrinkling, I must say. And so it wasn't the introduction of a heresy at that point. That's the key thing. You can see how in a lot of our frustrations are of that ilk in different ways, right? But it certainly opened the door and it led to it. I say it's very, very pertinent for us Americans because let's translate King Henry VIII, who wanted to keep his sense of Christianity alive and well in his country, but wanted his rule to oversee or be the final arbiter of things religious. That's kind of like in the United States of America, the federal government will be the final arbiter of things religious. We could see how if Christianity is strong enough and basic in the heart and minds of those who run the government, then Christian churches are fine with the federal government overseeing religious disputes, shall we say. But now they're getting more radical, and the Protestant view of the relationship between the king and the church, the church and state, is becoming more acute. And Christians, all kinds of Christians, are getting quite upset when the government says we'll interpret this religious question or that religious question. We'll be the final arbiters of it. That's exactly what is happening with the gay rights issue. It's exactly what's happening even with the mandate for the vaccine. Well, while on paper there's this thing called a religious exemption, many of the governors and political people are saying, well, we'll be the ones who interpret, we'll be the final arbiters of what a religious exemption really means. And so it is. So let's see. I think we got to take one more break, right, Nick? And we'll come back. I want to apply some of this stuff to a bit of the difficulties we're having with how to deal with the Novus Ordo and the Old Tridentine Mass, where it comes in. What I'd like to share is a bit of a sign of hope, or there's a bit of a bone thrown at those who are traditionally minded and like the old mass by some of the princes of the church, the bishops, and I think it can and should be used to promote true Catholicism in a kind of incremental way, I guess you could say. Anyways, let's take that final break here. I am Father Tom Coyce, the guest host on The Winds of Change. You are listening to the new EW10 Catholic Radio Voice for Chicagoland, WSFI, Catholic Radio on AM 750 WNDZ, and on 88.5 FM WFSI.
This is Bold Talk with Father Thomas Royal.
Should politicians who boast, or I mean claim to be Catholic, be excommunicated if they openly support and even celebrate abortion and infanticide? Those pushing for excommunication are labeled as right-wing extremists or conservatives. Catholic bishops who waffle or refuse to excommunicate these politicians are labeled as spineless or liberal. Such arguments always come to their usual impasse because they are approached in the usual bipolarism that has become the norm for all discussions in modern Western civilization. That's funny. The last time I looked, bipolar was a mental disorder. Answers are never found by swinging between poles in the continuous dichotomy of winners versus losers, liberals versus conservatives, man versus woman. Answers are found in living in the both and not in the either or. It is a way of looking at things from 360 degrees, a more integrated and comprehensive and therefore honest view. Excommunication is not a punishment. It is not a rod that bishops can decide to use or spare. Actually, the church does not excommunicate. It does not throw people out. The church does not have to do that. Excommunication is simply the church affirming the choice that one of its members has made to stand outside what the church, the mystical body of Christ on earth, is really about. It is just a matter of being honest. A person claiming to be Catholic can be excommunicated for a number of reasons, for example, if they are divorced from their previous Catholic marriage and remarried outside the church. People who have not received the sacraments of baptism and confirmation in the Catholic Church are not in communion with the Catholic Church, and therefore they cannot receive Holy Communion in the Catholic Church. As St. Paul tells us in his first and second letters to the Corinthians, excommunication is intended to be medicinal, always with the hope of the person once again coming back in communion with the church. Excommunication is also a way the church protects the integrity of the body of Christ on earth, which was purchased at the price of Jesus Christ's own blood. While excommunication may sting, like all medicine, it is designed to heal. We will be able to understand this only if we can think in terms of the both and not in the either or.
The Winds of Change.
St. Stanislaus Koska Academy. St. Stan's is an exceptional private elementary school in Chicago, serving preschool, age 3 and 4, pre-kindergarten, kindergarten, and first grades. We incorporate Catholic values and rigorous academic, social-emotional learning, Chinese, Spanish, STEM, and more, providing our students with leadership and life skills to transform our world. St. Stanislaus Kostka Academy is conveniently located one block north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway. To schedule your tour, visit ststandschicago.org. ststandschicago.org.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. That was a very nice meditation from Father Thomas Loya, one of our Byzantine Catholic friends and friend and personality of the Winds of Change. I was blessed to be able to attend his Vesper service the other day, last week, with the beautiful Tim Woods conducting singers and beautiful, beautiful harmony, all the chanting going on. Anyways, it does make us think about the liturgy. And unfortunately, of course, we're running out of time. But the idea of trying to go back into history and see how the Anglican Church, or called the Church of England, went from a schismatic church to a heretical church, not at the initial stage because of a stubborn man who couldn't get marriage right, and wanted to declare himself the supreme head of the church in England. See, that little phrase is where he could almost get away with it, in the sense that he's not declaring himself the supreme head of the church in the world. He's going to say, okay, well, let the Pope be the supreme head of the church throughout the world, but here in England, I'm going to be the supreme head of the church in England. And that's a subtle difference, and it might sound to many English people like, hey, yeah, the Pope in Rome doesn't really understand us, doesn't really know England, like us Englanders, and therefore our head can and should be able to veto or trump or contradict something that comes from Rome. Only the trouble, obviously, is if that were part of God's plan for the church, then what you're doing is saying any other country can and should do the same. So the King of France will be the supreme head of the church in France. The President of the United States will be the supreme head of the church in the United States, et cetera, et cetera. So therefore, if you're thinking myopically in a certain sense, you'll say, hey, well, maybe not so bad. So we have to see how that subtle difference, which may have bought him some time, and may, if there was some sort of recognition on the part of the king to succumb to a decision by the Pope, if necessary, kind of like what the Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire had to do when the Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire was consecrated or enthroned. He had all this power, of course, over armies and other kings and vassals of many, many, many folks, of course. But part of his coronation rite was saying that he will yield to the Pope if necessary, or when the Pope overrides him, he will, on a matter of faith and morals. And that's... when you think of the issue of an annulment, like the king's not getting his annulment because the Pope had rightly, I truly believe, thought, what a bad example, that the king would go through six wives. Well, the Pope didn't know it at the time, but the guy seemed like that kind of a guy that he could go through. Maybe if he lived longer, he'd go through seven or eight. But that's, in essence, it's not changing nature of the sacrament. See? Again, because there is such a thing as annulment, and it is open to people, then why is it abused? Yes, it was abused. And when there's an abuse happening, someone has to say, not this time or not now. And that's what happened. So, but let me, in order to get us ready for another show, Cramner's program for overthrowing the established liturgy had four stages. It has always been explained further in this book why he deemed it imprudent to do too much too soon. The first stage was to have certain portions of the unchanged traditional Mass in the vernacular. The second stage was to introduce new material into the Mass, none of which would, from the Catholic standpoint, be specifically heretical. The third stage was to replace the Mass with an interim English communion service of an ambiguous nature, destined to give place to a work still more radically altered. And let's see, the fourth and final stage was to replace the interim service by one which was specifically Protestant and could not be interpreted in any other way. So we're gonna have to study these different stages and how this incrementalism, especially really the first three stages, again, didn't cross the heretical line until the fourth stage. And that's what I think that's what's behind some of the feeling, the difficulty with the abandonment of the Tridentine Mass that's holding us together with a long tradition. So anyways, God bless you for listening. I am Father Tom Coyce. You've been listening to Winds of Change on EWTN Catholic Radio Voice for Chicagoland, WSFI Catholic Radio on AM 750, WNDZ and 88.5 FM WFSI.
What's there to say when the world makes no sense? Do we search deep for truth or sit on the fence? Can you see? Can you see? Can you see the winds have changed? We marvel and flatter such meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed. To say when right from wrong has become so obscure, it does not take that long. Can you see? Can you see? Can you see? The winds have changed. Truth left unsold, the truth left.